This is Divorce Happy Hour, a show about divorce and issues people face going through divorce. Your co-hosts are Christina Previtt and John Knocklinger. For more information about the show and to connect with us, head over to divorcehappyhour.com. And now, on to today's show. Welcome to Divorce Happy Hour. My name is John Knocklinger. I'm one of the co-owners of NetSquire, a virtual law firm that is devoted to helping people get divorced without fighting through flat fee, mediation, and uncontested divorce packages. You can learn more about us at gethappydivorce.com. But today on Divorce Happy Hour, which is going to be a half hour, we're going to talk about the division of assets and debt in a divorce. And obviously, that's one of the big issues that comes up in divorce. And it's one of the things that people get very confused about in terms of how does this all work? What kind of division should there be? Is it 50-50? Is it something else? Do different assets and debt get treated differently? Well, we can't answer all those questions on this podcast today, but we're going to at least talk a little bit about some of the concepts and some of the issues that we see on a regular basis when it comes to dividing assets and debt. So let's just dive right into what I think is the number one asset most people have, and that is the marital home. Most people who own a house, it's mostly going to be marital. Now, obviously, if one person bought the house before they got married and it was a short-term marriage, there's probably a pretty good reason why, you know, the house might not be divided equally. But if you bought the house during the marriage and you put it in joint names, regardless of who made the down payment or anything like that, it's going to be marital. And now we have to decide how we're going to divide the house. So here you are, you're sitting at a divorce, you're looking at your spouse. You really have three options. Either you buy out your spouse's interest, your spouse buys out your interest, or you sell the house. Those are your three options. There's really no other option. So that is the first thing you have to figure out, is which option are you going to choose? Now, in buying out someone's interest in the house, there's a lot of factors that have to be considered, like can someone actually qualify for a mortgage to buy out the other person's interest? You know, how much is that buyout going to be? Are there other assets that we can use to offset against a buyout of the house? So there are a lot of questions that you sort of have to answer before you get to the place where you decide which of the three options you're going to choose. But usually people, especially people that come to us that are amicable to begin with, most people have an idea of which one makes sense. Now, in a contested divorce, you'll see it very frequently where both people want the house. Both people want to stay in the house. We're not going to really go into that today. Some of that has a little bit to do with who has primary custody of the children, otherwise known as the primary residential custodian. That person will probably have a leg up in staying in the house. But let's just assume for purposes of our little conversation today that it's pretty simple. One of you decides you're either going to buy out the other one's interest or you're just going to sell the house. So let's talk about each of those things. Let's talk about a buyout first. How do you figure out a buyout? It's actually fairly simple. You get an appraisal done of the house, or you and your spouse can just agree on a value. And how do you get to that number? Well, people do different things. Sometimes they'll go to a realtor and get what's called a comparative market analysis, where a realtor basically says, here's what I think your house would sell for, or what I would list it at, or what I think the market would dictate that your house is worth. Or you can go on all those lovely little websites that are all over the place, like realtor.com, Zillow.com, Trulio, and all these other places where you can get values of your house. And you can just sort of go through all of those, figure out what makes sense, and agree to a number. Or you and your spouse can just hire an appraiser to go and appraise the property. And the beauty of the appraisal is it is what it is, right? Whatever the appraisal says is what your house is worth. But whatever you choose, you have to come up with a value of the house. And it is, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a fiction, because what is a house worth? A house is worth what someone will pay for it. So we're just sort of guessing what someone would pay for the house. But you get the value of the house and you subtract off all of the encumbrances on the house. So you subtract your primary mortgage, your home equity loan, home equity line of credit, any liens that are on the property, you subtract all those things off and you get your equity. And that is what we're splitting. Now, I would say 9 times out of 10, most people are splitting equity equally. Now, like I said, there might be reasons why equal is not fair. One issue that always comes to mind is if you bought the house like a year ago and one person used a significant amount of premarital money, money they had before they got married, as the down payment, maybe it's not fair to divide it 50-50. But those are the exceptions rather than the rules. For most of you, it's going to be a 50-50 split. But New Jersey is not an automatic 50-50 split. So that's important to know. It's not automatic, but most of the time it's not worth arguing about. You certainly don't get more just because you earned more and you contributed more towards the mortgage during the marriage. Those sorts of arguments don't hold any water under New Jersey law. So there's no point in even making them. Most of the time it's going to be 50-50. So now you've decided, let's say your house is worth $500, you subtract off $250,000 of what you owe, you now have $250,000 of equity. That means whoever stayed in the house has to pay to the other spouse $125,000. It's pretty simple, right? Now, how do you do that? Well, most of the time people will take the mortgage and they'll refinance it and just take out cash to pay off the other person. But usually a mortgage is in both parties' names. I mean, every once in a while, it's only in one person's name, but a lot of times it's in both parties' names. And just understand that if you're going to buy out your spouse's interest, that spouse is going to want their name off the mortgage. So regardless of where you get the money from to actually pay for their share of the equity, you're going to have to take their name off the mortgage. So that's something important for you to think about as you're moving forward, because, you know, you might have gotten a mortgage when it was 2% or 3%, and now mortgages are 6%. So there's some real life consequences to what you do with mortgages. Now, it's a settlement, right? We can do anything in a settlement. So sometimes people will agree that maybe the mortgage will stay in joint names for a period of time, or if it's in only one person's name and that's not the person staying in the house, maybe they'll agree, you can just keep the house. I'll keep the mortgage in my name for a while. But regardless, the buyout is half the equity. So there's no deductions for a hypothetical realtor's commission or taxes or anything like that. It's just half the equity. Nice and simple. Don't have to fight about it. Really easy. So that's if you're buying out the other one's interest, which happens fairly regularly, particularly if there's children involved, because a lot of times people don't want their children to be taken out of the school district where they live. They want the kids to continue there. So you'll see it happen very frequently. Another situation is, of course, the sale of the house, which sounds pretty easy, right? You just list the house for sale and you divide the net proceeds. Not so fast. It's not that easy. And this is where, dealing with an experienced attorney is actually very beneficial, because there's a lot of things that happen between the time you list the house and the time it closes that can lead to dispute. So what happens between the time you list and the time you sell? Well, number one, you got to find a realtor. So sometimes that's a fight all by itself. But, you know, you find a realtor, you guys have to agree on what you're going to pay the realtor. You know, can you negotiate with the realtor in terms of their fee? But once it's listed, then we got a couple of things that have to happen. One, house has to be shown. So that means the house has to stay clean. And now there's two people who are going through a divorce. So arguments come up on keeping the house clean, keeping the yard mowed and looking good, keeping the pool clean. All of those things have to be dealt with while the house is being shown. Then we have to deal with the inevitable certificate of occupancy that you're going to have to get to even transfer title to your house from the township where you live. So sometimes there's a cost involved with that. I know when I sold a property recently, we had a water system because it was a well water home. And because of that, there had to be all these new special certifications and testing and all this other stuff that had to be done. And it ended up costing money, and it ended up costing not an insignificant amount of money. So there's those costs involved. And then there's the negotiation over credits that the buyer is going to want from you in all likelihood once they get the home inspector report. And they're going to say, oh, that window doesn't work, or, you know, that wall has a problem, or there's a crack in the concrete that we think you should fix, whatever. But you're going to have to negotiate with your spouse whether you're fixing those things, whether you're not, what kind of credit you're going to give. All of that, again, is something that has to be negotiated or discussed. And then finally, accepting an offer, which sounds easier than it actually is. You know, you would think if you list the house for $500 and someone offers $500, it's a closed deal. But there's always inevitably going to be somebody who says, oh, someone offered $500 already. We can get more than that. Reject it. Let's raise the price. So that's something else you negotiate as part of your divorce is there going to be some kind of automatic acceptance of a particular offer so that you don't have to fight? So you go through all of these things, and as you can already tell, there's a lot. And there's a lot of things that should be addressed in your agreement. There's things, detail that needs to be put in there. There's negotiation that needs to happen. And that's where having an experienced mediator is really good, because what I can do as a mediator is guide you through each of those things that need to be discussed so that all of it's been discussed, you and your spouse are on the same page, and we can actually put that all in your agreement. So you're not going to fight because you've already agreed to everything. You're like, who's going to pay for something that happens to the house while it's being listed? You know, what happens if the hot water heater explodes? Who's paying for it? You know, you sort of figure out all those things so that you don't fight. And that's the whole idea behind a settlement agreement, is dealing with anything that is anticipated or could happen that's foreseeable so that you and your spouse are not fighting. That's the whole idea here. Divorce without fighting. That's NetSquire. Okay, so that's the house. And that's, you know, most people have the house. So let's move on to the other major assets that people have in a divorce that they need to resolve. One is bank accounts. Bank accounts are difficult because most of the time, the vast majority of people don't have a huge savings account. If you do, nice and easy, savings account, you divide. If it's a checking account, it's a little bit more difficult, because if you and your spouse are just putting your incomes into a checking account and you're paying expenses, you know, you kind of have to talk about that, because you can't just say, okay, as of this date, we're dividing it, because maybe after that date, expenses for the house are being paid or someone's paycheck is going into the account. So you have to kind of talk about how you're going to divide any money that's in an account that you have. And then there's going to be accounts that maybe were premarital, and you got to talk about those. So if you came into the marriage with a bank account, and let's say it's a savings account with $25,000 in it, and now you're getting divorced, and that account was always in your name, then you got to talk. Is that account not being divided? Did you do something with the account while you were married that maybe makes it where it should be divided? So those are issues that have to be discussed and raised as part of the conversation. And then, of course, you've got accounts for the kids. People have custodial accounts. They have UTMA accounts. They've got just regular old savings accounts. Now there's now these kids checking accounts. There's all of those accounts, which most of the time people do not divide, but you have to address them. You have to talk about them. You have to talk about who's going to be in charge of the accounts. Do both of the parents get access to all the statements? And what's going to happen if you put money into the account afterwards? What's the money going to be used for? Do you both agree that you can use that money to purchase a car for your child whenever they turn driving age? A lot of things to discuss. Next, we've got retirement accounts. That's really the other big issue. And when we talk about retirement accounts, there's a bunch of different kinds of retirement accounts. There's obviously IRAs, there's Roth IRAs, there's 401ks and 403bs, there are simple IRAs, there are pensions, there are deferred comp plans, there are annuities, and there's a bunch of other things. I'm just throwing out the big ones. And each of those types of accounts has to be dealt with differently. Now, what's difficult about dividing a retirement account? Well, there's two things in particular that make it difficult. And a third one on some accounts. So the two things that make it difficult on everything except for a pension is that if you started working before you got married, you've got a premarital part of your pension. And then two, your retirement account's not going to be divided immediately. You know, there might be a delay of a month or 2 months or 6 months before it's divided. And we all know the market goes up and down, up and down, up and down. So you've got to address those two issues. You've got to address what the premarital portion was, how we're calculating that. And two, are we doing anything for market changes from the date we make a decision on how we're dividing a retirement account and the day it's divided? You know, obviously those are two issues that are difficult. And sometimes people just agree on a number and they say, you know, the hell with all of the market changes. We don't really care. It's too complicated. But sometimes we can actually put in specific sort of formulas and sort of things we can do to make it very simple. And then on some accounts, there's something called a quadro that's necessary. That's short for Qualified Domestic Relations Order, or as I like to call it, a pain in the ass. So there's a special order that you do after you're divorced that divides certain retirement accounts. That would be things like a 401k, a pension, some IRAs, annuities, deferred comp plans. There's certain plans that have to be divided by this specific order. And that's an extra step that you have to take after you're divorced. And those require more negotiation, more fees, more time. So just retirement accounts are a pain in the butt. So usually in mediation, what I try to do is figure out a way, number one, to not divide things. You know, each person keep their own with just somehow figuring out a way to offset something somewhere so that we don't have to deal with dividing the accounts themselves. We just, you know, maybe give someone a little extra money from some other place, like the house maybe, or a bank account. It's one of those things where, you know, keep it simple, stupid with that phrase. I'm using lots of those little phrases today, but you just basically want to be in a position where you try to make your divorce as easy as you possibly can. And then we have pensions. Pensions are interesting. There's a lot of people that have pensions, particularly government employees, teachers, police officers, firefighters, military, just regular old government employees that work in bureaucracy, political appointees, everyone in between. There are these pensions. And pensions do require a little bit of work. And so basically the way you do a pension is it's a fraction. And the numerator, that's the top part of the fraction for those of you that have been out of school for a while and forgot about it. I'm just becoming reacquainted with fractions because my daughter is learning them right now in school. But the numerator is going to be the number of months you were married. And the denominator, the lower part of the fraction, is the number of months total that you work. So that number is continuing to change, unless you're already retired. But that number continues to change. The longer you work, the bigger that number gets. So typically you're going to get the spouse whose pension it's not is going to get 50% of the marital portion. So to make it simple, you were married for 2 months, you worked for 4 months, that's 50% of the pension's marital. The spouse gets 50% of the 50%, which means they get 25%. Okay, it's something like that. But then we also have to talk about making sure that there's a protection for the interest of the non-spouse on the pension. So sometimes we talk about life insurance and other things to secure their interest. And then we have sort of miscellaneous assets out in the world. One of them would be personal property. That's the stuff in your house. Your couches, your tables, your beds, you know, your outdoor furniture, all of that stuff, you know, we have to figure out who's getting what. And then there's, you know, if anyone owns any cars. So cars also have to be divided. Usually people just keep the car they're driving. It's been my experience that usually one spouse drives one car, the other spouse drives the other car. So it's kind of pretty simple, but it can get complicated. And particularly if one car was just purchased and the other one's paid off, we might have to talk about figuring out a value and giving somebody a credit. And then we might need to look at, you know, the blue book value of a car. And then if people own businesses or anything like that, we have to deal with that. So you can see assets, there's a whole slew of things. I'm just touching the surface, but I want to convey to you that it's complicated. that it's not just as easy as saying we're going to divide everything 50-50. There's a lot more that you have to talk about, which is why mediation is so effective, because we can actually sit here and talk about each and every one of these things in a very step-by-step, common sense way where you and your spouse don't miss anything. And more importantly, you don't fight about anything later on. I hear all the time, oh, John, we're getting along just fine. We're not going to fight. Yeah, I've heard that story many times over almost 20 years of doing this. You still put in those protections for both of you to ensure that everything is orderly. And then on the other side is your debt. Now, we already talked about mortgage and home equity line and those sorts of things. But there's all kinds of other debt that people have that you have to deal with. One is credit cards. Credit cards are difficult because if you're not selling the house, because if you're selling the house, most people just say all the credit card debt's going to get paid off at the time of the sale. But if you're not selling the house, you got to figure out how to deal with it. Are we just paying the minimum payments from now until the end of time? Is someone taking on all of the debt in exchange for something? Are we taking money out of a retirement asset to pay for it? You know, we got to figure out how we're dealing with the credit card debt. And then we have to deal with all the other debts that you might have, student loans, other long-term debts like care credit, personal loans, things like that. We got to deal, obviously, with the car loan, which I talked about a minute ago, and then any tax debt you might have. You know, is there a payment plan? How are we dividing that? So you have to make sure you go through each and everything. You know, sometimes people just say, oh, I keep my credit cards, you keep your credit cards. And that's fine. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer here. That's the one thing that you need to understand. And if you've been listening to our podcast, you do understand. There is no right or wrong answer. That's the whole beauty of settlement, is we can craft something that the two of you think is fair. But the goal is you have to make sure you address everything. That you make sure you deal with everything that you can, so that once you're divorced, you don't say, oh my God, we didn't address this. Or, wow, we forgot to talk about this. Or, oh my goodness, we just said we were dividing the marital part of our, you know, of this IRA 50-50, but we didn't discuss what the marital portion is. And now the stock market just collapsed and went down 50%. What does that mean? Does that mean someone gets 50% of what it was before the collapse, or 50% of it now? There's a lot of questions that you have to answer. And so it's very important that you don't just, you know, sort of phone in an agreement on a divorce. You have to make sure it's reasoned, and you have to make sure that you actually go through and you address every single issue, which requires conversation at the onset, which is why, again, mediation is such a great way to resolve your divorce, because the mediator can guide you through selling a house, for example. Who's doing this? Who's doing that? You know, who's going to do what by when? You go through and you figure everything out. Who's paying for what? Is someone going to get credits? So if you're thinking about going through a divorce, or even if you've already started one, please consider mediation, because it really is the best way to address all these issues. Of course, you can also do an uncontested divorce where you just provide all of your information for the agreement to our office, and we'll prepare the agreement for you and try to guide you on some things that maybe you didn't think about. But really, at the end of the day, please consider divorce mediation. It is, I cannot emphasize enough how effective it is at resolving divorces. If you have any questions, do not hesitate to direct message us. We welcome your feedback. We welcome your questions. We get them all the time. Please keep doing that. And if you are thinking of divorce and you're interested in seeing how our flat fee programs can help you and your spouse save a ton of money and time, please reach out to us. We'd be happy to have a complimentary call with you and your spouse to talk about mediation and what it can do for you. All right, that's all for this week's Divorce Happy Hour. You can find all of our prior episodes wherever you get your podcast. And we have episodes going back a long time on a ton of topics. So please don't be shy. Go listen to the podcast, and we'll see you back here next Friday for another episode of Divorce Happy Hour.
Thank you for listening. For more information, check out divorcehappyhour.com, and please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.